It is our great pleasure to be with Neil Gabler, whose many books now include Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. Walt Disney being that triumph, maybe, Bill Russell?
I hadn't really thought of this. You're talking about Snow White, and he does this all the way through, that he keeps working it and working it and working it, trying to make it perfect. One of the problems with, I would assume a biographer has this challenge. We were talking about it before we started. Certainly movie making has it. The problem is there is no easy encoding system. You know, 3x5 cards are you know, a tool, but it's not. And ultimately, one way or another, it ends up inside your head.
Oh, yes.
My experience is as a film editor or a video editor. And at some point, you know, you have all your notes out there, but at some point, the whole thing has to come together in your head.
Oh, that is so true.
And the alternative, of course, is to get it out there. But once you get it out there, so you can collaborate, it loses something. It becomes a corporate undertaking rather than an individual. And not to say one is better than the other, but there is sort of a pristine purity to that single vision. There's also an obsessive compulsive portion of that.
There's no question. I mean, anyone who does this kind of work has to be obsessive compulsive. And I actually wrote a piece for the Washington Post Book World last November that I called Method Biography.
Mm.
And the idea was that every biographer is a method actor. Mm-hmm. More than anything else, more even than a detective or psychologist or archaeologist or whatever, every biographer, if he's any good at this job, is a method actor. Because you have to internalize that life. You have to take all of those note cards, and you've got to somehow internalize them, forge a life out of them. And you've got to find the correspondences in your own life to the life of your subject, or the book won't have any life to it. Biography is a tactile business. It's tactile in the writing of it. When you hold in your hand those documents, you know, I held in my hand the letters that Walt Disney is writing, the original letters that he's writing from New York to his brother Roy and his wife Lillian in Los Angeles when he's trying to sell Mickey Mouse because he doesn't have a distributor. He's made these films on what we call spec, on speculation, that he's going to sell them. And you hold in your hand those letters written sometimes 2 and 3 a day, and you're flipping through them, and Walt Disney, you know, enters your fingers and your body through those letters. But he also enters your consciousness. And you become, in effect, Walt Disney. Again, if you're any good at this. And I spent 7 years on this book, so I can say, with all honesty, that I lived with Walt Disney in my head for 7 years.
The way that he lived with his films in
exactly,
his head.
Exactly. And you know, one of the other comments I make in Method Biography is that the writing of the book replicates the life of the subject. And what you said, Paul, is exactly true. I mean, I had to be obsessive compulsive when I was writing the book in the way that Walt was. Walt was under tremendous financial strains, which may surprise a lot of our listeners, that Walt Disney was under tremendous financial pressures after Snow White through the opening of Disneyland. He was almost always on the ropes financially and was on the verge of bankruptcy many, many times. Well, I'll tell you, writing this book, I was often on the financial ropes, frankly. And when I was writing about Walt's urgency, you know, I was writing about my own urgency as well. Now, that may be revealing too much, but I think it gives the book a sense, again, of the tactile. And here's another thing. I researched the book. I researched the book, and I research all my books in chronological order. And I'll tell you why I do that. Now, that may seem like a logical thing to do, but not all biographers do it. I do it because we all know that Walt Disney is going to be successful. But Walt Disney didn't know.
Right.
So when you write in the moment, when you stay in the moment with your subject, you have a sense of suspense as well as honesty that you don't have if you write as if you know the story. I try and forget the ending of the story, frankly, as I'm writing.
I'm told that Barbara Tuchman says that about anybody who is writing about history, that you have to not know how it's going to come
That's
out.
That's right.
This is a curious variant on that famous line, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
That is so true of biography.
And it's interesting in this context, and you're saying it so forcefully brings it. this will sound harsh, like a criticism, but it's not. There's an incoherence to this
book.
In the most positive sense.
That, I hope so.
Yes.
That recapitulates Disney. I mean, all, you know, we talk about perfection, and I think most of us have a platonic sense of perfection, which is to say it is there, it's fixed forever and ever. Mm-hmm. And I think people, we have that same idea about people, particularly historical people. And in a lot of it, it's the way we're taught history. You know, this is the cartoon version.
Exactly.
And this is how people really are. Well, they're not. And Disney never did. I mean, there were parts of him, there were parts of him, I think, that never talked to one another.
Oh, I think you're absolutely. He was a very compartmentalized man and not a very introspective man, which is a difficult thing for a biographer. You know, it's wonderful to have someone who introspects, which is why, frankly, you know, I'm going to tip my hand here. It's so much easier to write about literary figures who are much more introspective than to write about someone like Walt Disney, who is not introspective at all. So,
and if he were, he wouldn't tell you.
Exactly, yes. So, you know, you're right. He's a very compartmentalized man. People with whom he dealt saw different sides of him, different facets of him, but no one ever saw the man whole.
Did he ever see himself whole?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
I really don't think so. You know, I think Walt Disney saw himself as a man on a mission. And he was determined he was going to fulfill that mission. And it turned out to be a series of missions because Walt was an odd fellow in this sense as well. He operated on what I call renunciation, by which I mean that when he realized something was not going to be as good as it had been, and I'll give an example right here, the animations. He comes to a realization in the mid-1940s that he's never going to make an animation that was as good as Snow White, Pinocchio, Fantasia, and Bambi, because he doesn't have the financial resources, frankly, to do so anymore. Then he renounces animation. He says, if I can't make another great animation, I don't want to make any animations. Now, of course, the studio makes animations. They go on and make Cinderella and Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan and Lady and the Tramp and 101 Dalmatians. But Walt Disney has surprisingly little to do with any of those films. He moves on to the theme park. And then when he achieves what he wants to achieve at the theme park, he renounces that and moves on to something else, which turns out to be Epcot, not as we know it, but as Walt Disney visualized it, which is a fully operational city of the future. So Walt operated in a series of renunciations.
He also insisted that this wasn't about money, and it was about money. Blessedly, he had Roy, his brother.
That's right.
That made it possible. He, you know, it allowed him to focus, but it, you know, as he gets older, you know, for all he's still saying this isn't about money, he becomes extremely, excruciatingly acquisitive.
I found myself angry with him that he was, by golly, going to do what he was going to do, and Roy would be the one who would
clean it up.
Yes. Yeah, and maybe there are reasons I was, but it wasn't fair.
No, and it's an absolutely accurate depiction, I think, in your responses is a certainly understandable one. Walt was going to do what he was going to do no matter what. If it bankrupted the company, it didn't make any difference. And he made those animations, those golden animations, at a tremendous loss. He made the shorts for a long period of time at a loss. He wasn't making profit on those things, and he didn't care. And he would say to his brother Roy, 8 years older than he, the chief financial officer of the company, as most people know, and he would say to Roy, look, it's your job to get the money. It's my job to come up with the ideas. It's your job to get the money. He was very disdainful of Roy because Roy wasn't a creative person. On the other hand, Roy was very protective of Walt, ran interference for Walt. And, you know, as you said, Bill, I mean, this company could not have survived. And Walt wouldn't have survived had it not been for Roy Disney. He would have been thrown out of the company many years earlier because he was determined to do what he was going to do.
Well, what's the difference between being a spoiled brat and being a genius?
Well, they always say money is the difference between being a lunatic and being a genius. And in a certain extent, that's true for Walt Disney because he did have Roy there to provide the money for himself. And Walt was a visionary. I mean, let's not stint him on that. I think it's fair to say that Walt was the visionary force of that studio. Walt created those animations full-blown out of his head. As I said earlier, you know, that projector was always running in his head, and those animations were his.
And they were darn near perfect.
They were. I mean, not Walt's eyes, because the problem with being a perfectionist is that you're always condemned to live within the failings of your own abilities. They can never attain perfection. Walt always lived within the nimbus of disappointment because nothing was ever as good as he wanted it to be.
He was also, part of what was interesting is he wasn't just creative. He was also had a remarkable faculty for the mechanical.
Yes,
and,
he did.
And the visual. And in some ways, that was, you know, another part of this character is his, you know, his, he was a tinkerer.
He certainly was a tinkerer. And of course, that's why he got into animation. You know, animation combined the two halves of Walt Disney, so to speak. I mean, the artistic and the mechanical. It was perfect for him.
And then there was the Dickens part of it that he would be able to express. We'll come back in just a moment with Neil Gabler. A lot more about Walt Disney, a lot more about the other half of that title, which is The Triumph of the American Imagination. Be with us when we return.